Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to this, the start of Season 8 of Choral Chihuahua. Today, we've got a fascinating episode about choral conducting. I'll be speaking with Patrick Russell, who's not only the outgoing head of choral conducting at the Royal Academy of Music, but also director of music at the Brompton Oratory, which is one of the churches that Sammy and I were talking about at the end of our last episode about music for the services of Tenebrae. And you'll note how important the liturgy is to Patrick's music making. He's joined by two of his ex-pupils, the very busy Hilary Campbell, who is founder and director of the professional chamber choir Blossom Street, musical director of the Bristol Choral Society, the West London Chorus and West London Chamber Choir. She's also been an associate conductor with Ex Cathedra and has conducted the BBC Singers and Symphony Chorus. And alongside her is Jack Appley. He's the music director of the Goldsmiths Choral Union, Concordia Voices and Epsom Chamber Choir, as well as working with choirs in Hungary, Sweden and France. Let's get Hilary to say the words.
Welcome to Choral Chihuahua.
Day up, down, day up, down.
We're going to start with some music straight away. Paddy, I'm going to go to you first. We've had free rein in our choice of repertoire that we've selected. And you're going to introduce us to your first track.
Yeah, the first piece I've chosen is by Victoria. It was published in his Holy Week collection of 1585, the same collection that has those fabulous Tenebrae responsories. And I've chosen this because it has a big liturgical significance for me. It comes at a moment where the church really starts diving into the darkness of Holy Week, and it accompanies the moment when the Blessed Sacrament is actually carried by the priests in solemn procession from the main altar in the church into a side altar, into privacy, if you like. And this music has been composed by Victoria to cover that particular period. It's based on a wonderful Spanish chant melody, which has a very prominent augmented fourth coloration. You hear the first verse sung in the chant form, and then there's a wonderful five-part polyphonic setting with the chant in the second voice down. It has wonderful richness, a wonderful sense of yearning. I love it because it's the sort of choral sound that I love. It's polyphonic, it's long-breathed, it encourages choral colour, ensemble colour and text colour as well. And this is me conducting the oratory choir.
Tantum ego sacramentum.
Yeah. Tantum Ergo by Thomas Luis da Vittoria, the choir of the London Oratory, conducted by one of my guests today, Patrick Russell. Paddy, I've wanted to get you into Choral Chihuahua for some time now, and in many ways you're the perfect guest for an episode focusing on choral conducting. You've been rightly described as one of the leading figures in English church music as performer, teacher and scholar. Would you like to give us just a little précis of your working life?
Gosh. Well, I started off living in darkest Wiltshire. It was in a country parish. My father was a gardener. I lived, the parish where I lived had the most fabulous Baroque chapel with a Baroque organ in the back. I loved singing. I'd always loved singing. Apparently, I was singing hymns from the age of three. I started playing the piano by ear when I was four, started having piano lessons when I was five. But the choir in the church where I was didn't have children. It was grown-ups, and my father was the only tenor in the village. And he was, bless him, a wonderful natural musician and a lovely Irish tenor voice. His mother was Irish, but he couldn't read a note. And so there I was, aged 8 or 9 or 10, teaching him the tenor parts of the well-known Palestrina and Victoria Masses, and Bird in particular, all in editions by Henry Washington, who was director of music at the London Oratory, the job which I now hold. So it's strange the way the wheel turns. I then went to the local Anglican Grammar School, where my director of music saw I was musical, and he put me to the organ, and I fell in love with that. So I suppose from there on I came through, really through, although my cradle experiences were Catholic and they're hugely important to me, this very strong objective liturgical base, but this torrent of emotion running underneath it. But my training really as a teenager and then as a student was really through the classic Anglican system, to which I'm very, very grateful. So I went from my grammar school to New College, Oxford as an organ scholar, but I sang as well. I sang alto in the Clerks of Oxenford under David Woolston. And then started working in London. For 6 months I was assistant to Martin Dale Sidwell at St Clement Danes Strand. He was an extraordinary musician, a chip on both shoulders, but incredibly gifted, and no nonsense. And he, anyway, after 6 months then a job came up at the Oratory, and I've remained there. I was assistant for a year, organist for 20 years, and now director of music for 25 years. And I started teaching in the conservatoires, sort of junior departments, doing a little bit of depping and then teaching in my own right. I didn't enjoy that, I have to say. I don't think it's the right age range for me. But I got booked as a deputy, both at the college and at the academy. And that's where things began to stick, really, at the academy. In particular, they seemed to like what I did. I was teaching harmony counterpoint first. And then after 5 years, the then principal David Lumsden wanted to start a church music course. It was only an afternoon a week, but he asked me to do that. And then 10 years later, it was decided that needed to become a first study rather than an elective. And the best way to parcel that up was to actually make it a choral conducting course. So that's actually how I started really teaching choral conducting at degree level. But I had actually been doing it at the academy since 10 years before that, since 1987. So really I've been combining these two areas of working in professional church music in London with really just a cracking group of singers, always has been, I mean world-class ensemble singers, and then teaching very, very gifted students. When I get irritated by one place, then the other half of the week I go to the other, and it's kept me sane and challenged in various ways. I consider myself very grateful. I will just say this: my students all know this. I've never actually got any job that I've actually applied for, except for professorship at the University of London and my organ scholarship at New College, Oxford. Other than that, if I applied for jobs, I didn't get them, or else the jobs I did get, I was offered. I don't think it would happen now, but you know, nature sometimes abhors a vacuum, and I seem to have been in the right place and very lucky.
What is it about organ scholars singing alto in choirs?
I really don't know. For me, it was as a youngster being taken to the Eddington Festival and hearing James Bowman sing. Mm. And he was in the choir then. And actually, I heard him sing when he was still in the choir at New College, Oxford.
Oh, that would
when
do
he
it.
When he dominated the sound and the whole character, the music making. I was a good treble, and I just sort of carried on singing. I'm sort of a natural choir master baritone, but I sang alto, and I like to think probably I was not a bad alto either.
Very good. I was in Oxford with the 16 last weekend, and I went to a New College to see the new plaque that's been put in the cloisters as a memorial to James, because I wasn't able to make his memorial service. Put you on the spot, Hilary. If you were to say, choose one thing that sticks in the memory from what you learned from Paddy.
Oh my goodness, impossible. One thing. I think Paddy taught us so well that he enabled us to trust ourselves, which meant that we could build brilliant relationships with choirs. And I think in terms of memory, of course, none of us will ever forget being forced to sing Bruckner's Lockersiste and sing it and conduct it for hours and hours at the start of the course, and a piece that most of us still can't quite go back to yet. it's impossible, Eamon, and I could bore you for days with all the brilliant nuggets of wisdom that Paddy has imparted on us. And I think most students will remember their trips to Niederösterreich as being incredibly, incredibly wonderful memories that taught us so much about music making. But every day was the format of the course. You were singing, you were conducting, you were involved, you were learning from watching others, you were learning from Paddy teaching you, and everything was wonderfully collaborative and always inspiring.
Let's have another track now. Hilary, let's go to a piece that you've chosen. Maybe you'd like to introduce this one for us.
Yes, absolutely. This is Love Bade Me Welcome by Judith Weir, a setting of George Herbert. I have long been a fan of Judith's music and of Judith. I'm a huge fan of the way in which she can take such little material and let it very slowly develop into the most beautiful, vivid imagery, but in an incredibly pragmatic way that allows both amateurs and professionals to really get something from her music. So I could have picked any number of pieces, but today I've chosen Love Bade Me Welcome. And this is the Erik Eriksson Chamber Choir performing, conducted by Fredrik Malmberg.
Thank you.
You're absolutely right, Hilary. The simplicity of just two-part writing and the very moving beauty that she can achieve with just those two parts, I find that rather a nicely paced performance, actually. I like the space that it has.
I was saying to Eamon, I find it a little on the slow side. I think it's just a little bit slower than her marking. There's a kind of translucence and a simplicity about all her choral writing. It's extremely elegant, and it's disciplined without being austere. It's real style. I think, and there's a real elegance about it, and she's such an important voice, I think, for our choral tradition.
My favourite moment is about halfway through, when you have those, at the beginning you have those two lines interweaving, and halfway through just that big expansive chord just opens up and the basses go all the way down to the bottom, and it's a lovely round rich sound, and it's contrast to what came before. It's beautiful.
It's actually something which that performance does actually bring out very well. The sonority is wonderful.
Yes, there's great depth and resonance, but real purity to that sound as well.
Typical of the Swedes.
But there are very few recordings with female voices. So I like that colouring. As Jack said, when then the tenors and basses come in, it doesn't, for me, create quite the same shift if you've got trebles.
Paddy, let's talk about the Royal Academy of Music initially. The choral conducting course, it's your baby, really, isn't it? Although it's nearly 30 years old now. Something of a groundbreaker in its time?
There were developments happening at just about the same time at the Royal College of Music. But it is strange, isn't it, with the English about the English tradition. And we've always had this interest in training choirs, but not so much in formal training, and certainly not at degree level for conductors. And it always been thought of as a skill that could be learnt merely by watching and copying. And there were some great choral conductors who came through that system and that process, but I think not enough. And I was very aware, and I'm sure you have been as well, you know, there are an awful lot of choirs who really need saving from their conductors. And so having really been told, when I was asked to take over the church music course at the Academy in 1987, oh, you'll be doing the choir training class, I am started to really get interested in the process of how do we teach, how do we conduct. I was subjected to very different styles of conducting in London to what I had actually seen in Oxford. I think a much greater willingness to develop a wider range of choral colour was what I found in London, as opposed to the choir stall discipline. Admirable that it is. That's part of our tradition, and there are aspects of that we mustn't lose. But how to deal with professional singers, all adult singers, this interested me. So after about 10 years, it was really with the advent of the new principal at the Academy, Curtis Price, and his vice principal, Jonathan Freeman Atwood, who is now our principal, who said, look, this needs to be a first study. How do we parcel it? So I proposed that it should be choral conducting and church music in those days, as a kind of a strap, as opposed to what was beginning to develop at the Royal College of Music with Paul Spicer, which had a slightly wider stylistic perspective. I thought that doing it through church music would be a real seller. And an international seller as well. And you play to your strengths and you try to minimise your weaknesses or disguise your weaknesses. And that's what I did. Yeah. And then we dropped the church music sort of subtitle a little bit later on. And really it became, in fact, it was choral direction. Again, that tells you something about the English tradition. Choral direction, a bit like traffic management. No, it's more than that. It's conducting. And we'll probably come on to this. It's conducting. Yeah. And that's what really... And as I talk more and more, I become more and more interested in the whole process of not just choral conducting, but conducting itself.
Mm. So, I mean, when you watch conductors, one sees so many different styles or techniques. How does one set about teaching it?
What I try to do, which is consistent, is try to make sure that the conductor, has a very clear oral perception of how the piece should go, and how they would like the piece to sound, and then see whether that is actually shown in their presence, in their body language, or is there stuff there which is actually getting in the way. And certainly early on, most of what I find myself teaching is actually taking stuff away rather than putting stuff in. Although there are some things, we have to sing, we have to show legato. We must show legato. And we have to show that we empathise with the whole process of breath. And that's absolutely vital. But
and how do you, obviously we can't see you doing, but how does one show legato in conducting?
It's through manipulation of space and consistency of beat speed, and also getting the hands, but sometimes the hands are quite unnecessary, actually showing actually where the support comes. I mean, a little trick I now have is showing students actually sometimes how unimportant the hands are by getting them to start a piece without hands, without head, and turning away from the choir.
Right.
So all they can see are actually the intercostals and then the engagement of support. And they'll be staggered how often actually the choir will come in perfectly together without everything else that actually can get in the way: preparatory beats, nervousness, nodding of the head, all these sorts of things. Tension and relaxation.
Hilary and Jack, as students, you were coming to study with Paddy as postgraduates, so bringing a degree of experience already. You know, practicing conducting, what was the sort of useful element in that? You know, did you literally stand in front of a mirror and practice?
It's so difficult, isn't it? Because if you're a clarinetist or if you're a pianist, you've got a physical instrument in front of you. Singers, I also struggle with this as well, because obviously their instrument is inside them. They can't really sort of see their instrument. And, you know, as hard as I tried to imagine, you know, the BBC singers in front of my, you know, in front of me when I was practicing in front of the mirror.
When you are conducting a choir, you're wearing so many different hats. One of them isn't really, your focus cannot really be on what you're doing. You're trying to make music for them. So then the beauty of being able to do it in class was that you could be entirely selfish about it and try to improve yourself, still to enable that music to be better, but you weren't having to think about, okay, what do I need to do now to help my ensemble along? This was something that was for us.
This is very important for young choral conductors, and I often say it, is that when you're trying to change physical defaults, and it's very necessary that one does change unhelpful physical defaults, you need to do this in dry dock, and you need to do it by continual physical practice. But then when you are on a Thursday night, you know, rehearsing your Mozart Requiem with your choral society, you know, somewhere in the sticks, you really mustn't think about technique then. You mustn't think about technique. The technique eventually has got to become a natural physical default. You can practice technique, I think, when the choir is entirely self-propelled. I have to say, I used to conduct, practice my own technique very much before I was director of music at the Oratory, and I was conducting the Oratory Junior Choir, but still teach and running my amateur choir, but teaching the choir training class at the academy already. And it was in things like hymns. I had the time I could afford to actually be thinking, am I standing right? Am I breathing right? How much do I need to show? How much do I actually need to wave around? How much can I really do through presence? What's the balance between the totality of presence, what I'm showing through the face, what I'm actually showing through my own physical support, and what I'm doing with the hands? And you can play around with that pyramid, triangle, of contact with your singers, because of course it will vary through the whole process of music making. Through, you know, as your singers possess the music more and more, your role becomes a different one to what it was in at the beginning when you're purely initiating. But in the concert, you're doing other things as well, and you have to be aware of that.
Different golf clubs in the bag.
Exactly that. Let's have another piece of music. Jack, your choice, please.
So I've chosen a piece by the contemporary composer Caroline Shaw. It's quite wacky, it's quite different. It's from her piece called The Isle. I discovered this recently, and I love Caroline Shaw's music, and it's quite different and very interesting.
Sometimes a thousand
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Isle is full of noises, magical noises indeed. Caroline Shaw's Caliban, the third movement of The Isle, performed there by Roomful of Teeth, with, I believe, Caroline Shaw herself as the soloist. It's very striking, isn't it?
I mean, it's interesting that she's an American composer, but, you know, there's something Celtic there as well, which as a Howells fan, I think he's a real Celt as well.
There's also a sort of almost Björk quality to it, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then this sort of slightly strange, almost organum effect, where the second solo voice comes in. And then that Jack, I mean, you wouldn't have seen it, but the hand gesture that accompanied this sort of full ensemble sonic impact that arrives in the middle of it.
Can't help it.
Incredibly well tuned as well, isn't it? I mean, it's this great.
I think just intonation, I think, is absolutely it's extraordinary. The stylistic range that really needs just intonation.
Just intonation. The tuning of chords to acoustically pure intervals as opposed to the warped ones you get on keyboard instruments. See efagilini.com/tuning.
Yeah, well, Robert will be nodding his head furiously when he's listening to this. And that vocal fry, the vocal creak, yeah, which is one of those...
the aisle is full of noises.
Exactly, yeah. It's one of those advanced vocal techniques, which I remember having to do in Nelly Was a Lady, a piece we used to do with Eve Fagellini, where I had to sing a bottom B.
Okay.
And the only way I could do it was to employ this sort of vocal fry.
Yeah.
Paddy, you've had a huge number of students through your programme now. Any idea how many it is?
Probably getting on for about 60, I suppose, at master's level.
Yes,
of course, and then probably a lot more. Maybe doing my weekly choir training class, which I still do, which is for organists and any other students within the academy who wish to, have a bit of clinical work. So people like Stephen Grahl and Daniel Cook. Even Marcus Farnsworth occasionally used to turn up to it. So, it's what I enjoy is that there's a sense of community and that there can be sort of conversation and dialogue about the skill and the art and the problems and the choirs we have to deal with and the choir committees we have to deal with as well.
Lord.
So
it's a different skill set.
Nearly 60 students on the master's course.
I think that's a really useful thing. No one ever talks to me about dealing with committees or dealing with difficult choirs. It's just stuff that I learnt on the street. And actually having someone to sort of steer you, to equip you with some tools to deal with those issues when you first encounter them as a young conductor, I think is incredibly useful.
I think the collegiate aspect is great because there's an awful lot of stuff very often which I can't help with, but around the cup of coffee in the cafeteria, one shares things, and even if I don't have experience of them, sometimes you can say, look, actually just take a deep breath.
But and those support networks we've sustained, I think that's another lovely element of the course, because when you're conducting a rehearsal, there is an element of separation. And I think being able then, as Paddy says, to be able to go and share that and discuss it and get help and suggestions from people that have been through the same thing is crucial to the longevity of our careers, I think.
It's a mental health thing.
Yeah.
Actually, that sharing.
Yes.
It's very important.
Particularly, it can be quite a lonely profession as well.
Mm. Yeah.
You're the only conductor in the room, and you're usually, you're on one side of the podium, and then you've, potentially hundreds of people like opposite, and it can be quite scary, and you feel very, very seen. But one thing that Paddy always used to talk about was that the conductor on the podium is the best conductor in the room, which is a very important lesson, which I think holds very, very true. And it's interesting. I know we might go on to talk about dealing with singers. It wasn't until I did more professional singing that actually I realised the truth in that statement, because, I was a trained conductor. But I was going into a slightly different realm of being a professional singer. And there were some conductors who I was working for who might not necessarily have had the background that I'd had going through Paddy's course. But actually, you're about being a respectful professional and being, respectful of the person on the podium. And actually, you go with the musical ideas that they're going for, and even if sometimes they're not always what you would do yourself, as a mark of respect, you've got to go with that because they're the best conductor.
I think this is very important for the young conductor, because you're very often going to be placed, if your first time in front of the BBC singers, and their corporate knowledge and corporate experience and possibly corporate stylistic awareness is going to be hugely vastly greater than yours. But that's not what they want. What they want is someone to take the decisions. They know that's their job. Mm. Someone actually has to take the decisions. It's your job to make sure that there's musical credibility. It doesn't have to be decisions they like, and they will accept that. They just want actually the decisions to have some musical logic and justification. And then they will actually accept that. I think sometimes very often people don't realise this about professional singers. What they're looking for are really quite simple things.
Yeah.
They're wanting for a good tempo. They're wanting someone to look after after balance, agreement, so that they know someone who is interested in, that they can do things all in the same way. And then they will go with you and they will support you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants a conductor who doesn't know their own mind. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
In fact, or indecision.
Exactly that. If a friend of mine told me, a viola player who I work with, told me recently about a concert in the 80s. I forget who the conductor was now, but he said to the principal trumpet, so Mr. So-and-so, what do you think we should do at this point? And the first trumpet stood up and said, well, if you don't know, I'm not hanging around to find out. And he stood up and the whole orchestra left.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
And they came back for the concert in the evening.
Wow.
It was absolutely brutal. Apparently, this was what orchestral life could be like in the 80s in London. This friend of mine has got a myriad of stories like these. In fact, I should get him on at some point to share some with us.
I'd just say, though, decisive indecision is okay. If you want to say, can I try it this way?
That's a different thing.
Could we actually just see what it sounds like that way?
Yeah.
They won't mind.
No.
As long as you then make a decision that after that.
And indeed, having the confidence and the self-awareness that if you've decided something in advance in your preparation that you think is going to be great, doesn't work in practice, being prepared to change your mind quickly.
They really respect
Definitely.
That.
Yeah.
They really do respect that.
Yeah.
It seems to me, Paddy, that there have been more ladies studying choral conducting than working as choral conductors, maybe particularly at the Royal Academy of Music, before the more recent growth in there being female conductors of orchestras or doing orchestral courses. Are you conscious of that? Has that been on your mind at all?
I didn't actually ever look at the numbers, actually. Colin Metters was running the orchestral conducting course. Now, of course, it's Sian Edwards. I suppose actually over my course, I think it's probably about 40% women to 60% men,
right,
actually, still. But I think there was a kind of cultural acceptance that it was okay for women to conduct choirs, and it was particularly okay for women to conduct youth choirs and children's choirs, which of course is quite wrong, really quite wrong. And so, somebody like Sophie Genard becoming principal conductor of the BBC Singers is a very, very important moment, and
yes,
it has to be the start of something. Of course, there were always female conductors going through the academy course. People think Odelinda Martinez, there was Susanna Malky, Andrea Quinn, but I think we're beginning to have the beginnings of a kind of mass now that has its own force and doesn't need explanation at all. But this it still slightly worried me, and still does slightly worry me, I think, the view about women as choral conductors, that they can do the younger sort of choirs, and that's okay. And
the
lower
level stuff.
It's not.
As well.
Yeah.
I think there is still a perception about that. It's okay to direct a school choir, a youth choir, maybe a community choir, but far fewer women working with the professional groups or the top level amateur ensembles. And I think what Paddy has done in encouraging lots of women through the conducting course is definitely creating waves, but there's no sense of parity yet.
But I mean, Hilary, you've got a wide-ranging portfolio now. Do you feel that you've had to work harder and to achieve that?
As a woman?
Well, yes.
Interestingly, I don't think that I did think that, but I recently discovered that two groups that I have directed, one that I still work with and one that I no longer work with, that both of them almost didn't appoint me because there was a man who was nearly as good as me. And that was the decision that they had to take. Should we risk having a woman on the podium, or should we take the man? He's not quite as good, but he's a man. And I was quite surprised to discover that, because obviously, having then been appointed, you don't know what's gone on behind the scenes, which has led me to think about it a little more. I was actually having a sort of similar discussion with Alice Farnham a few days ago about women coming through and about what you were saying about this wonderful emergence of lots of female conductors working with orchestras. So you'll never know. You can only put yourself in your own shoes. I'll never know if I had to work harder because I'm a woman. I feel really fortunate to work with the groups that I work with. I love the kind of variety that I undertake. Were I a man, would my portfolio be different? I won't know.
It's difficult to tell, of course, isn't it? Because there is no defined career path for any of us.
That too.
And you know, we're all examples of this portfolio career.
Yeah.
That we're trying to build. I mean, the insecurity of the freelance lifestyle, I've been doing this quite a long time now, it still weighs heavy on my shoulders.
Mm. Yeah.
It doesn't seem to get any easier as the years go by. Of course, it's a sort of challenging time for anyone working as a freelance musician currently. But, I mean, Jack, you're at the sort of earlier stage, sort of that. You know, this. How does one, as a young conductor, set about building a career? How do you develop your portfolio?
You've got to be... I think enthusiasm feeds quite a lot of this. I think and willingness to get involved and try things. I mean, that event, that ultimately is what got me involved in this profession in the first place. When I was at school, I was conducting when I was about 16 years old because I wanted to make a difference and make things happen. And, you know, that enthusiasm is still just as strong as it was when I was about 16 and I'm about to turn 30. So, you know, it's good. But I've found that a willingness to travel has been important in that.
Yep.
Not everybody is necessarily willing to do that. That's not a good thing, or it's not a bad thing. It's but there was a time at my absolute busiest. I was about a year or so ago. On a Sunday evening, I'd have a rehearsal here in London. On a Monday evening, I'd be directing university. Upper Voices at the University of Birmingham on a Monday night. I was on trial for a job in Sweden, and I would get back to London at 1:30 in the morning, sleep for a few hours, get up, the alarm would go off at 4:30 for a 7:30 flight from Heathrow to Gothenburg. I'd take two rehearsals in Gothenburg, stay overnight there, come back first thing on a Wednesday morning to take a rehearsal for another job, which I was on trial for.
Yeah.
Then
that's only half the week.
And that's only half the week. And then I had another rehearsal on a Thursday. I would sleep for 2 days.
Yeah.
And then it goes again. Yeah. And it was, I was a zombie. I was an absolute zombie.
And that's very typical, I see, of a lot of the young conductors who I know doing similar roles to that. I mean, Paddy, your long stint at the Oratory and the Academy has largely spared you from that, which is probably a good thing.
But in the early days, I wondered quite what I was going to do, because, I mean, the Oratory certainly wasn't enough to live on there. You were doing conservatoire teaching. Actually, the wisest piece of advice I got was actually from my director of music when I was at New College, and as I was about to depart, and it was David Lumsden. And he said, you've got quite a lot of strings to your bow. And he said, keep them all going as long as you can.
Yeah.
You conduct, you play. In those days, I used to play the violin and viola. He said, you never know, that may be useful. Mm-hmm. You write.
Were you still singing at
and,
that point?
And I was still singing. Mm. Do the lot. And in fact, certainly the organ playing, when I have to deal with orchestras, my string experience comes in extremely useful. The writing has fed off into some small but in some ways significant scholarly aspects and understanding how scholarship and academic discipline works, and I've managed to put them together my own way.
Mm.
You all had a different skill set which you've used in your own way, and you can hear how Hilary, and who's a composer as well, for example, and Jack have been using theirs, and that's what I would say to any Jansson. I mean, you think of someone like Owen Park, for example, mm-hmm. who is as a composer, he's a conductor as well. Yeah. But he will bring both things together. You know, and you can think of other, examples like Oliver Nussen and people like this. You know,
I think it's not only that it helps create work for you, but one discipline informs the other as well.
Exactly that. I mean, people have often said to me, "Oh, you know, how much longer are you going to keep singing for?" As long as I possibly can, because yeah. I absolutely need, you know, the input that the singing brings to my conducting and vice versa.
Exactly.
That brings us quite nicely towards our next track, Paddy. Your association with the music of Herbert Howells, which is how I first encountered your name, actually, when I was an undergraduate. I remember buying an edition of the Howells Regina Caeli, which we're about to hear, and it was your name as the credited editor of that edition.
Yeah, I suppose this is the discovery or the corpus of Howells's music for Westminster Cathedral that he wrote in the 19-teens is the sort of the bit of scholarship that I'm most proud of. When I was at the Oratory, I had heard from John Hoban, the then director of music, who had sung at Westminster Cathedral for George Malcolm, who actually later became a very, very important influence on me and a very good friend, that Howells, as a RCM student, had actually written a body of music for Westminster Cathedral, for the Catholic liturgy. I mean, this is a context that one doesn't think of Howells as being in.
Mm-hmm. And you think of all those canticles, don't you?
You think of the Anglican Church music. Mm. It's a very, very long story and far too long for this, but through various strokes of luck and then persistence and inquisitiveness, I managed to find actually quite a lot of this music. Still not found all of it, but there's a mass. There were four Marian antiphons, of which Regina Caeli is one, of which two are still missing. There were a couple of Verburden office hymns, a setting of the Haec Dies, a setting of the Nunc Dimittis in Latin, of which I discovered the manuscript actually only 2 years ago, which was in Australia, of all places.
Wow.
And is now back at the Royal College of Music.
Is that available in an edition now?
They're all published. It's all published by Novello, except for the Mass in the Dorian Mode and the Haec Dies, which are published by the Church Music Society, of which I'm now the chairman. A little plug there. Yes, I was keen to do this music. He wrote this particular piece in 1915. It's a very interesting shape. It's almost like a little tone poem. There's a rising figure, Regina Caeli, which he works in various ways, oscillating between G major and B flat. And it builds up to an enormous climax, Resurrexit Sicut Dixit, perhaps depicting the resurrection itself, but more actually just the explosive nature of this proclamation of the angel to the Marys who are being talked to. And then the fade out at the end into just one choir as he comes back into G major, having been in B flat, is absolutely magical. I've always imagined it to be like sort of, you know, the sun of a wonderful Easter morning, sort of just dissipating all the dew on the grass. It just disappears away. Fabulous thing. I also ought to say I'm rather proud of the cast list for this performance, but because it includes one Eamon Dugan on bass and also Carolyn Sampson, no less, on soprano one. I inherited Carolyn when I took over the Oratory Choir. I'm very, very proud of that. Very proud of that. Classy team.
Yeah.
That was Regina Caeli by Herbert Howells, with Patrick Russell conducting the Choir of the London Oratory.
And a very fine baritone lineup there, including my other 16 colleague, Ben Davis, and Mark DeBell and Jeremy Budd in the tenor section as well.
All right. Starry.
So, yes, Anghara Griffith-Jones on soprano as well, to mention just some of the others. It was a good team. And that, to me, encapsulates almost sort of everything when I think of the oratory sound. It's muscular, but very refined. It's a big building, the oratory, and when you know we're singing from a, or I was in your choir for 6 years there, the choir sing from a gallery to the right of the church as you're facing the main altar, singing into the main body of the church. So it's quite a big space to get into, isn't it?
Yes, the church is a dramatic space. It's a grateful acoustic. The liturgy itself is grand, but fairly objective. It's not dominated by personalities. It's very Roman. It has a tremendously strong sort of sense of impetus. That sound was, I have to say, is the psychology of that sound was something that I inherited. It was something which was really established by John Hoban in the 1970s. And was continued for about 4 years by Andrew Carwood, who succeeded him, and then I succeeded Andrew in 1999. And very, very much to my taste. As I said, I was influenced very much by George Malcolm, who I used to play continuo for when he would conduct the English Chamber Orchestra. And he became a very good and a close friend. Actually, I played for his funeral. And he would come up into the organ loft when I was organist, and I could smell the Gauloise wafting over my shoulder as I played. And when I conducted, he would come and watch. And, you know, I can still remember him commenting on my conducting of the Dvorak Mass in D, for example, on a Sunday morning. But he was a
favourably?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad to say yes. Actually, he liked the way I dealt with the 6-4 in the Kyrie. But he was one of the great musicians, and again a Celt, and very, very passionate, but also very disciplined, buttoned up, and a real refined musical sense. So I've tried to do that head and heart, and you know that's my way of doing the polyphony, and I try to make a continuity between how we do the polyphony, then moving back into the chant, which I like to sort of interpret to a certain extent, and to use the voice and to use vocal colour, and then coming forward through the Viennese repertoire, which again is you know, the Viennese masses of Mozart and Haydn, very much part and parcel of the oratory tradition. Later music, less so, although we have certain pieces that are always done, Mendelssohn's La Decision, for example, which is very rarely heard except for there, and is a wonderful cantata. So, yes, I mean, it's a choir of 14, expanded sometimes to 16 or 18 with a band to do the Mozart Requiem, and the effect is entirely plausible within the building, even with those small forces.
It's very funny hearing you talk about your experience of George Malcolm coming to your concerts and commenting on your conducting, because Paddy came to my concert 2 weeks ago and commented on time signatures in Derufle's Requiem and how I was navigating them favourably.
Oh, yes,
very favourably, which I was very, very grateful for. But yeah. It's very amusing hearing the lineage and the stories about what's happening.
But isn't that another lovely element of the Academy as well, that you're there as a student for 2 years, but your education continues forever through Paddy, through other former students that are in so many ways connected. You keep learning.
Working with singers, you said that you sang as a boy and as a countertenor when you were at college. I love, what was the description you had as a choir master baritone? Was that what you said?
Choir master baritone, yes.
Yes, yeah, I like that.
Well, I think, I really think, actually, a choral director should be able to sing probably about 3 or 4 notes. You know, I think sometimes a choir just needs, you know, I mean, it's their job to sing. That's what they're paid for. It's your job to conduct and to listen and to comment. But just occasionally, you know, if you can do something that says, you know, go on, do it. You know, 9:45 on Sunday morning, and you know you get something coming from the back row that really isn't properly warmed up, then, you know, if you can sing the first three notes of the Palestrina Missa Brevis, then it's just a little shot across the bows. But don't try to do more than that, for God's sake.
Personally speaking, I think that one of my advantages as a conductor working with choirs is that I've sung to a very high level, and I've studied singing a lot. I know quite a lot. I like to think that I know what's under the bonnet and how to get the best out of singers, but that can also bring difficulties with it, in that some singers don't like to be challenged, they don't like to be sung at, which I also understand, and that's something that I learnt the hard way, I think, when I first started working with professional choirs, was that I actually needed to sing a lot less in rehearsals and demonstrate less. But it's very useful when working with non-professional choirs. I mean, Hilary, obviously I first met you as a singer, but, you know, do you demonstrate a lot in rehearsals?
I think it depends entirely on the kind of group that I'm working with. I guess it probably goes that the higher the level of ensemble, the less singing I do. But it also repertoire can determine it. I don't sing a lot. I used to, like Jack, when I first graduated, I was working with, I think at one point, 10 choirs a week, because it was an office choir in the lunchtime and then go on to my evening rehearsal. And when you're working with community groups and office choirs and groups particularly comprised of singers that might not even read music, you inevitably have to sing a lot more because you're teaching them the music and you're teaching them vocal technique, but you're also teaching them the actual notes. As I have worked with higher level groups, I sing a lot less. But like Paddy said, it might be to demonstrate a particular colour that I want to explore, but it's not something I do often.
I tend to work more with pictures, quite a lot with pictures, particularly of amateur groups, because I think it's good to keep people engaged, it's good to give people an idea of what I'm thinking about the music, because I would find that as a singer a much more engaging experience than being told, well, that note's wrong, you know, this is wrong, could you do this, or whatever. I think actually trying to give people a picture or a postcard to work with
absolutely
can be very, very effective.
And I think people will have different opinions on this, but I use the vocal warm-up often as a way to try to tap into a colour that will then be pertinent to the repertoire that we're going to work on.
Yeah, I do exactly the same with that. This has been fascinating. Thank you for your time and thoughts. But we should probably think about wrapping up before too long. I'd like to play one more piece. This is Tu es Petrus by James McMillan. And Paddy, when we were chatting just before we started recording, you mentioned that you were actually at a performance of this at Westminster Cathedral.
No, I wasn't.
Oh?
No, I wasn't.
Okay, there you go.
I saw it on the television.
Oh.
And I've watched it on YouTube since. I mean, the whole atmosphere, the 2010, Pope Benedict coming to the UK, this reputation before he was Pope of being sort of God's Rottweiler. And when he arrived, we found that there was this wonderful, gentle, cultured man who was clearly, even on television footage, clearly interested in the choirs that were singing at Westminster Abbey. You can see him turning to the dean as James O'Donnell is conducting and saying, "Is this your choir?" And then at the end, James being presented to the Pope and proudly showing his papal insignia for the papal knighthood, which he was allowed by the dean to wear, even though he was working in Westminster Abbey. And then the next day he turns up to Westminster Cathedral, and there's footage of him actually shaking hands with all the choristers in the long corridor afterwards. But the beginning of Mass, which was what this was written for, Tu es Petrus, of course, is the text of the Durufle motet we know, and I remember hearing that being performed by Stephen Cleabury and Westminster Cathedral Choir when Pope John Paul II visited Westminster Cathedral. But for this, James McMillan came up with something absolutely extraordinary. On the YouTube video, you can still see the way that the beginning of this piece virtually sucks all the air out of the room, and the Pope is sort of visibly taken aback. And then absolutely loves it. I mean, the sound, it's very simply constructed.
It's knocking socks off, isn't
it? It's as if the earth is opening up. Apparently, the original scoring was to involve steel doors, which had to be beaten. They couldn't find the steel doors, so they had to do make do with tam-tams. And the brass were at the opposite end of the cathedral. I don't know how they recorded it, but for the service, the first performance, the brass was up with the organ in the West Gallery, and the cathedral choir was right at the other end of the cathedral in the behind the high altar where they now are. And my current associate, Charles Cole, at the oratory, was actually conducting the brass group down with the organ and the tam-tams from the West End. Just fantastic ability of James McMillan to write music for an occasion. Mm. Absolutely, total bullseye.
You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church.
Thank you.
Tuas Petrus by James McMillan, Westminster Cathedral Choir and London Brass, conducted by Martin Baker. Knock your socks off music. As Paul Spice has said of that, it's music to send shivers up the spine.
Indeed.
Very striking. Paddy, Jack, Hilary, lovely to have you with us today. Thank you for your time. Paddy, one reason that you're here today in particular is that you've announced your retirement from your role at the Academy. I encounter your students all the time, where people applying for the conductor scholarships with Genesis 16, many of whom have actually been your students, the ones who've gained that position, but I'm meeting them all over the place. I can always tell your students. I only need to see them conduct for a few moments to know that they've come through your stable. Always very, very clear. The gesture is incredibly enabling, with a good range of gesture, and this constant flow with this legato that you mentioned earlier in the programme. I think, I mean, are you pleased to hear that that's a hallmark? If you see that, is it nice to know that people are going out with a sort of recognisable stamp on them, as it were?
I suppose, yeah, in a way, yes. I think I'd be most pleased about is if it has the same effect. And I think enabling, I think, as you said, I think that's the most important thing, I think. I certainly wouldn't want everybody to look like me. And I am proud of the fact that actually my students are all having different sorts of careers, different sorts of balances, and are showing different personalities and different sorts of creativities. That I am proud of. I'm really very, very proud of that.
And looking forward, what would your sort of hopes be for the course as it continues?
Well, I think the reason why I stood down was, I, you know, I've been doing it for 27 years. I still love teaching. I think I teach as well as I ever did. I will continue teaching, freelance, private, etc. And there are some schemes. I'll be taking a little bit of time out for the Academy. I think that's right. But I think any course, I think, needs new contacts, new opportunities, new energy, sometimes maybe even different emphases. And my successor, Nicholas Chalmers, is extremely well equipped to bring all that to the Academy. I look forward to seeing what happens there in the future and supporting him as best I can.
That's great, and we wish Nick all the very best as he steps into your shoes in September. That's it for today, folks. My thanks to Hilary and Jack and Patrick Russell. Robert and Nick will be back next time, and we'll see you then. Bye for now.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.